Selected Shorts is supported in part by the loyal friends of Selected Shorts. To join, or for more information, visit selectedshorts.org.
I'm taking meetings with people who are theoretically going to give me a deal. I have no idea what I'm doing. I later found out that neither did my agent, Marcy. She would call these production companies or networks I was meeting with and say, "Mike needs a deal," which I think is the opposite of how you get a deal.
This week on Selected Shorts, a comedy writer tells all, and fishing for a life.
We started urchining right away. The skiff had a 20-horsepower Evinrude on its stern, and as we motored out of the harbor, I got some great footage of Jane with spruce, tufted islands in the background. When I looked out at the open ocean, I couldn't help but be overwhelmed by its seriousness, its incredible depth and expanse. Looking out to where the earth curved was like trying to imagine the rest of your life, all that remains unknown.
Hello, this is Isaiah Sheffer. Coming up now is Selected Shorts from PRI. There's nothing more compelling than a terrific story performed by a great actor. The ones you'll hear now were recorded live on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. Okay, boys and girls, this edition of Selected Shorts is about Men on the Make, two American tales of young men seeking their fortunes. Now, when Kathy Minton and I were considering that title for this program, we conceded that it has more than one meaning. On the make can mean seeking to gain success, but it can also, and often does, connote sexual conquest. In the two stories you're about to hear, the young man in the first story is a comedy writer looking for a sitcom deal. And in the second story, the two guys looking to get rich in fishing for urchin roe don't exactly have sex far from their minds. With me today is our commentator and friend Hannah Tinty, founding editor of the wonderful One Story magazine. Hannah, I've always wanted to ask you, what do you think is the connection between worldly success and sexual conquest?
Well, I think most men equate one with the other. Maybe it's true, because sex is a lot about power, but I'm not a man, and I don't have any plans to conquer the world. I'm just a writer typing away at night and trying to get down a good sentence or two. Mike Birbiglia, on the other hand, has had a lot of success. He's a regular on Comedy Central and shows like Conan O'Brien and David Letterman. His off-Broadway show, Sleepwalk With Me, was recently turned into a book and published by Simon & Schuster. The Deal is a hilarious recounting of his first attempts at show business. Stand-up comedy, it seems, is just like anything else in life that takes time to be good at, like writing or love or even sex for that matter. You just have to keep embarrassing yourself over and over and over again until one day you're maybe just slightly less embarrassing than the day before.
Right. At a Selected Shorts program produced in collaboration with Ira Glass and This American Life, Ira Glass picked Mike Birbiglia to include his story and read it himself. Here he is to read his tale of a man on the make, sort of, The Deal.
My agent Marcy called and said in her charmingly high-pitched voice, "You need to fly to Hollywood immediately. Immediately." I had just returned from the Montreal Comedy Festival where I had performed in the New Faces of Comedy category. "I've set up some meetings for you," said Marcy. "Oh, okay," I said. "Well, what are the meetings about?" She said, "We gotta get you a deal." I said, "What kind of deal?" She said, "A sitcom deal." Marcy told me stories about Ray Romano and then a bunch of people I had never heard of who got deals after this festival for ridiculous sums of money. This seemed like a perfect situation. Someone was going to give me a ridiculous sum of money, and I needed a ridiculous sum of money. At this point, my bank balance was in parentheses, which means, let's say you had money, it might be this much money. But since you don't, you owe us this much money. If I could get a deal, I could stop temping at the pharmaceutical company where each day I would fall asleep sitting up. So I said, "Count me in, Marcy. Let's go get a deal." I didn't even like sitcoms. I didn't want to be on a sitcom. What I wanted to be was a traveling comedian, but I thought, this will be the thing that'll get my parents off my back. My parents had been urging me to get out of comedy and make a real living ever since I had announced my chosen profession. The first time I told my father I was performing at comedy clubs, he said, "Comedy clubs? What do they do, strip?" I said, "No, they perform comedy." And he said, "You can't make a living doing that. This kid needs some goddamn reality testing." He had a point. Not about the stripping, but about the career choice. The overwhelming majority of comics lose money each time they perform. By the time you include your many expenses, gas, tolls, rental cars, fung-ins, the $75 gig fee disappears fast. But this didn't concern me because I had a long track record of delusion. I'd always had scattershot ambitions. As a kid, I wanted to be a rapper, a comedian, a poet, a professional basketball player, a country singer, a breakdancer, or the owner of a pizza restaurant where third graders could hang out. Maybe I'd be some combination of these things. After all, if Kenny Rogers can do the country singer slash fried chicken restaurant combination, what could stop me from being an NBA baller who also happened to own a pizzeria for third graders? Breakdancing was actually the first of my life goals, and maybe it was a little bit of a stretch. First of all, I'm not good at it. I have no flexibility and very little rhythm. On the other hand, I did have a large piece of cardboard, as well as a mixtape called Awesome Summer 82. But even if I'd gotten my popping and locking figured out, it's really hard to pay New York City rent with a day's worth of nickels thrown at you on a subway platform. But I didn't have that information on the blisteringly hot summer day in 1984 when my siblings took me to see the movie Breakin'. My mom had finally given up on asking questions like, "Is this movie appropriate for a six-year-old?" Instead, she just asked my sister Gina, "It's the 2 full hours, right?" Then we climbed out of the station wagon and our mom sped away. Inside the theater, I was instantly sold. I was just like these urban teenagers who breakdance competitively. Seeing how my older siblings and I were the only people in the theater, aside from a mother and her son, we danced along with the movie. First, we breakdanced in the aisles, and then when no one objected to that, we breakdanced on the carpet separating the screen from the seats. Everyone had a great time, but I had an epiphany. I am a breakdancer. My dad is a doctor, and I'm a breakdancer. My siblings were completely behind me. The next day, they invited their friends over to our house and said, "Mike, show them your breakdancing moves. They're so good." And I was off to the races, flopping around on the floor, my legs flying around in the air. Everyone was laughing and having a good time. I was so good, I didn't even need music. It was my first brush with live performance, and so in sixth grade, I tried my hand as a rap musician. When the Shrewsbury Police Department visited St. Mary's School to conduct their Dare to Keep Kids Off Drugs program, I saw the opportunity to launch my career as a rap star who also happened to hate drugs. Incidentally, could there possibly be a more confusing acronym for trying to keep kids from experimenting with drugs than the DARE acronym? Hey, kids, we're here today to dare you not to do drugs. We dare you to accept our dare. Officer, does that mean you want us to not do drugs or to do drugs? We dare you not to do drugs. But I thought we weren't supposed to do things that people dared us to do. I mean, if you dared me to jump out of a tree, I shouldn't do that, right? It's just an acronym, son. What's an acronym? The point is, it was confusing. But I still got my free DARE t-shirt, and the day before we were to receive our DARE certificates of completion, I took the chance that could ignite my fledgling rap career. I approached Sister Mary Elizabeth and proposed that my friend Eric and I perform a two-man rap song called Bust Them Drugs, a riff on Young MC's 80s hit Bust a Move. Originally, there wasn't going to be a talent portion of the show, but I thought a parody rap song with all new lyrics was in order, and for whatever reason, she thought that was a good idea as well. Maybe she had the foresight to realize that 22 years later, I would need a ridiculous antidote to demonstrate what an attention-starved, delusional maniac I was. Or perhaps she thought it would buy her another 5 minutes to sit in the back row with her eyes closed, reconsidering her lifelong commitment to Christ. If Young MC had happened to walk into the basement of St. Mary's School on that spring morning and witnessed Eric Marciano and me prancing around with microphones, screaming our made-up lyrics to Bust Them Drugs over his lyrics to Bust a Move, I'm not sure he would have been too impressed. We were a good 3 or 4 bars behind the beat, repeatedly referred to our notes for lyric reminders, and since we didn't have the instrumental version, our lyrics collided with his lyrics, actually quite harshly. It was kind of like an early mashup. Even Eric and I, who thought we were pretty good, realized that our rap performance would have to be cleaned up a little bit before we hit the road. We'd also need to get the instrumental version of Bust a Move. Well, my propensity to delude myself carried over into my adulthood, which is fine, because I think to be a comedian, you actually have to be delusional. I think the human brain can't process the amount of judgment that an audience casts upon you when you do stand-up comedy. You know, if you're in a play and it doesn't go well, the audience thinks, well, we didn't like the script or the set or the costumes. With stand-up comedy, if people don't like it, they're basically saying, we don't like you. You know, your personality. I can't even describe my first time doing stand-up. I was in a contest, and it felt like I was undergoing anesthesia. I came off stage, and I asked my friend, how'd it go? And he said, you're gonna be okay. One of the judges of the contest was a comedy club booker slash restaurateur named Evan. He asked me if I had a car, and I didn't, but my girlfriend Abby did, and so I said, yeah. He said, I can set you up at a place called Fat Tuesdays that will pay you $50 if you perform 30 minutes of comedy. Now, what I should have said was, I only have about 11 minutes of comedy, tops. And what I did say was, yeah. So I drive Abby's mint green Ford Taurus to Fat Tuesdays, which, if you're not familiar, is one of those days of the week restaurant chains. TGI Fridays, Ruby Tuesdays, Ash Wednesdays, Holy Thursdays. Fat Tuesdays wasn't as much a comedy club as it was a bar that had a comedy night. Frankly, comedy club is a pretty subjective term to begin with. To have a comedy club, all you need is a bar and then a wall of 8x10 photographs of comedians. I mean, they don't even need to be comedians, just people photographed in black and white looking zany, you know. Well, I'm 19 years old, and I show up at Fat Tuesdays, and I look up at this wall of photos of people who may or may not be comedians and think, well, these people must be geniuses. How do I get my picture on a wall like this? I try to pick out the famous ones, the Chris Rocks, the Jerry Seinfelds, but they're not on this wall. It was kind of like being handed a stack of old baseball cards and flipping through them, trying to find the Reggie Jacksons or the Pete Roses. But it's just all Felipe Orlandos and Dan Pasquales. Optimistically, I think, these must be the real comedians, the underground guys who are the real deal. So now that I've been thoroughly intimidated by the headshots of Catherine Klosterbaum and Ted Finkelstein and his red puppet Fiddlesticks, I'm whisked backstage being the sidewalk of a strip mall. And I'm scared to death because they've agreed to give me $50 for 30 minutes of comedy, and I know that I do not have that. I ask Matt Marcus, the comedian I'm opening for, I say, hey, what happens if I run out of material? And he says, just make fun of people. I say, I don't know if that's going to go so well. Whenever I do that, people punch me in the face. I later find out that's a whole genre of comedy. You know, these guys, they walk on stage and they're like, nice shirt, faggot. And people are like, it's so true. His shirt does suck. This guy's a genius. I'm from Jersey. But it's a popular regional genre, but certainly not my forte. And so I'm standing on the sidewalk, and I'm holding a 3x5 index card with 5 bullet points. And I'm desperately trying to figure out how I'm going to stretch this into 30 minutes of comedy. And the index card says, stick insects, Cookie Monster, A-Team, Teletubbies. This was the material. I'd hate to be a stick insect because all the other insects are always bumping into you because they don't know that you're there. And you have to be like, watch it. And they're like, yeah, you look like a stick. And you're like, I have eyes. And they're like, yeah, they were closed. So that's stick insects. That's the whole joke right there. In my mind, I'm hoping that'll last 3 to 5 minutes. The next one went, I'm not sure if Cookie Monster is a great role model for kids. I mean, do you think this guy might have an eating disorder? He only eats cookies, and the back of his throat is sewn up. The cookies fall off his face. Who is he kidding? So that's Cookie Monster. That's the whole joke right there. I'm thinking, that's got to get me over the 10-minute mark. And then, I love that show, The A-Team, but sometimes I get the sense that they weren't really trying. Like, if you're on the run from the law, you might want to go easy on the gold chains and feathers. Maybe take the red stripe off the van, just a couple ideas. So that's A-Team. And so I'm thinking, you know, this is definitely not going to last 30 minutes. And the manager opens the door, and he says, Mike, you're on. And I turn around, and I throw up on the sidewalk because my body couldn't think of another plan. It was just like, what do we do? Let's get rid of some food, you know. And I walk through the door, and I've heard many bastardizations of my last name in my life. It's Birbiglia, in case anyone didn't hear the introduction. And this is the worst one I'd ever heard. The guy on the loudspeaker says, please welcome Mike Bahuski. And I was so mad. I remember thinking, he didn't even try. He just said B and whatever he could think of, and he made me Polish, and that's a really specific choice. And I walked on stage, and I did 4 minutes of comedy, because when you're bombing, it pares down, and there's complete silence, you know. It's almost as if these people hadn't watched Sesame Street, Teletubbies, or The A-Team in years. I walk off stage, and the manager calls me into his office, and I'm so nervous. I mean, it's just me and this strange man in his office, the size of a telephone booth, and I fear the worst. You know, does he have a gun? Is he going to punch me? But he doesn't. He takes out $50, and he hands it to me, and I say, thanks, and as though the gun scenario had never crossed my mind. And he says, can I ask you a question? And I said, yeah. And he says, do you have an 8x10 photograph of yourself? I said, no, I don't. And he says, can you send me one? And I said, yeah. I drive home, and I know what I have to do if I want to have a comedy career. I need an 8x10 photograph of myself immediately. At 1 a.m., I walk into my girlfriend Abby's apartment, and she says, how'd it go? And I pause, and I think, and then I say, it was amazing. It's 11:30 p.m., and I get off the phone with Marcy, and I book the first flight I can to Los Angeles. For the next few days, I do what everyone in Hollywood does. Instead of their jobs, I take meetings. I'm taking meetings with people who are theoretically going to give me a deal. I have no idea what I'm doing. I later found out that neither did my agent, Marcy. She would call these production companies or networks I was meeting with and say, "Mike needs a deal," which I think is the opposite of how you get a deal. I think you have to pretend you have all kinds of deals that are about to happen, like you're going to pass out if you're handed one more deal. You can't tell them you need a deal. I thought Marcy and I had kind of a secret code language, but no, that was kind of our strategy. Mike needs a deal. For 6 days, I stayed on my friend Adam's couch, and he chauffeured me around town. I couldn't get a rental car because they don't accept parentheses, so he would drive me from meeting to meeting. Adam is gay in a stereotypical way, where he criticizes the way I dress and look and act. I would go to these meetings, and it would go okay, and I'd come out to the car, and Adam would say, "You look fat in that shirt," and I'd be like, "Oh, thank you. I was feeling pretty good about a second ago, but I'd been meaning to have my self-esteem knocked down to -1,000. Well, TV executives call these meetings general meetings, though they really ought to call them meaningless events that make it seem like we shouldn't lose our jobs, which we should. These are meetings with networks and companies that have quirky names like Pinball Machine Productions, or serious names like Serious Productions. You know those companies that have their names on the ends of TV shows, but you don't know what the hell they do? Well, I'll tell you what the hell they do. They have general meetings. And they're about 30 to 60 minutes long, and they're kind of like a speed date. You know, what do you do? How do you get started? And the way to look cool in these meetings is to act like you have no idea why you're there or why you'd ever want to talk about show business in any context. You say stuff like, "Isn't it crazy that polar bears can hear their prey from 30 miles away?" And they're like, "Mike Birbiglia is so interesting. He doesn't care about show business at all." And then my agent, Marcy, would immediately call and say, "Mike needs a deal." So I'd go to these meetings, and the people in the meetings would insist that I was going to get a deal. They'd say things like, "You're definitely going to get a deal." And, "You don't have a deal? You will." Then they'd wink like they knew something I didn't. After a few days of this, I started to believe it. I was like calling everyone I knew. I was like, "I'm about to get a sitcom deal." I think "about to" are two of the most dangerous words in the English language. Never trust people who say things like "I'm about to" or "because I'm high." So at this point, I'm calling my parents, my brother Joe, my friends from college. "You were wrong about me. I'm about to get a deal. I'm going to have my own sitcom. I'm going to date Heather Locklear." Even my dad, always skeptical, took note. He said, "How much money do they give you for these deals?" And I said, "I think like $100,000. My dad said, "Well, I guess I'm in the wrong profession." And I said, "Yeah, I know. Who needs some reality testing now?" A few days later, I flew home, and as I'm sitting on the plane, it's occurring to me that I don't have a deal. I think, what about my deal? That lady from Emerging Pictures said that I was going to get a deal. The guy from Air Conditioning Productions told me I was a genius and should maybe co-host some kind of polar bear animated feature thing. I land in New York, and I check my messages. No messages. I call Marcy. "Hey, what's up? What's going on with the deal?" Marcy says, "I don't think it's going to happen. No one's getting deals this year." I found out later that this is what they tell people who don't get deals, that no one got a deal. But they did. Some people did, just not me. I get back to my tiny apartment, and I look at my parentheses balance, and I feel so tricked. I was made to believe that my life was going to be fixed, and it wasn't. I was the same loser who had flown to Los Angeles on my sister's frequent flyer miles 6 days before. It was my first brush with a business full of fast talkers. They had convinced me that my life was going to be changed, and it wasn't. I think this was the reality that my dad had warned me about.
Mike Birbiglia performed his story, The Deal, part of his new book, Sleepwalk With Me. After our brief break, you'll hear a story read by Thomas Gibson, star of TV's Criminal Minds. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. For more information about the stories you're hearing or the readers who are performing them, go to selectedshorts.org or wnyc.org/shorts. And by the way, we love to hear any questions you may have, so come on, feel free to ask. Lewis Robinson, the author of this next story, Seeing the World, about a young man who leaves home to seek his fortune and maybe some women, is the author of the novel Water Dogs and the story collection Officer Friendly. He was born in Massachusetts and was a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop in 2001. Now, you know him, Hannah.
I do. I first met Lewis Robinson back in 2004 at the Breadloaf Writers Conference. He's a fellow New Englander and a great guy. He's a really talented writer. His work reminds me a lot of Cheever and Alice Munro. Most of his stories are set in Maine and carry the same starkness and beauty as that lonely northern state. In this tale, Robinson's narrator is trying to see the world by becoming a filmmaker, filtering his experiences and trying to add drama. But by the end of his adventure, he doesn't need a camera anymore. Life has plenty of excitement all on its own.
Seeing the World is now read by a veteran leading man of the Selected Short series and a star of TV's Criminal Minds, Thomas Gibson.
I was 17 when I met Johan. He was 35. We worked together in Portland at the Twilight Cineplex on Forest Avenue. I worked there because I had designs on being a movie director. I figured that any remote connection to the movie industry would further my cause, and in Maine, at 17, the Cineplex was the best I could do. To Johan, it was just a job, but he had other talents. During his first shift, I'd been there a month. I was wiping the glass top of the candy cabinet, and Johan stood next to me with his hands in his pockets, watching. We wore red bow ties and white ruffled shirts. He asked, "You like girls, Sam?" "Sure," I said. "Me too," he said. "But you kind of hate them too, don't you?" "Heh." He coughed out a fake-sounding laugh. He was tall, with a wispy mustache and messy blonde hair. He had the kind of good looks best appreciated at a distance or on film. Up close, his skin was cratered with acne scars and his eyes were hazy. "Sometimes," I said. "Me too," he said. And he told me about his wife. He'd been married for 3 years to a woman in Bangor, but when she pressed him for a baby, he'd said no way. Then she tried to kill him. "For real?" I asked. "Poison," he said. "Poison? Rat poison," he said. "She put it in my coffee." "Sounds like a good reason to move on," I said. "You got a lady?" he asked. "Nope," I said. "You're lucky," he said. But I disagreed. It was tough for me to get dates, and I'm not sure why. I wanted to blame it on the fact that I lived at home with my mom, but the more likely reason was that I spent too much time with my video camera monkeying around. By the time I'd met Johan, I'd already shot 18 tapes of video. I was churning through batteries, flitting from project to project. For a while, I was dead set on documenting this rock and roll band, kids from my high school. I was convinced that they were going to make it big and bring me with them. As it turned out, their trajectory was flatter than I thought. They played too infrequently and drank too much Jägermeister, so I junked the plan. The first shot I took of Johan was this one. He sat on the concrete steps outside his apartment building, smoking in his Cineplex uniform, with the clip-on bow tie hanging from his collar unfastened. I filmed while I drove with the window down. He squinted at the sun as he smoked. I clicked the power zoom button and spoke into the microphone like a TV anchorman. Johann waits for his ride, smoldering with regret. While we worked, Johann had a lot of questions for me about women, and though I felt he was in a much better position to answer them himself, having been married, he disagreed, saying a fresh set of eyes could do him good. He liked to talk about sex. We shared stories in the quiet lobby while the movies were playing. Later, after the last showing, we'd lock the doors and run one of the movies again. We'd sit in the theater with at least one seat between us, and Johann would shout at the actors on the screen, "Oh, please," he'd yell, "give me a break, that would never happen." I shortchanged him for sure. I knew nothing about women. All of my stories were fabricated. He never seemed to think I was lying. He just thought I was funny the way I said things. Usually the conversations entertained me, but sometimes they made me feel pathetic for being so inexperienced. He could talk about one woman's body, the soft, invisible hair on her upper lip, her smell, the way her hip bones felt, the exact topography of her breasts, for an entire shift. I videoed one of the conversations, and Johann went on and on like a natural. That's when I knew. Johann had the kind of jazz I was looking for as a subject for a movie. He was like a combat soldier, a war hero. You could see it in his eyes. He was intimately acquainted with the battlefields of the heart. It was obvious. "The best way to hook a woman is to make her hate you first," he said. "You know it," I said, nodding. "That way you can only improve." "Absolutely," I said. We'd been working together for a month when he knocked on the door to my house. Mom was a history teacher, so she had summers off. We were watching Cool Hand Luke. When I opened the door, there was Johann holding an armful of clothes. "The washing machine in my building's on the fritz. You don't mind, do you?" I shrugged. He walked in. "Great place you've got here," he said, looking at the kitchen, then down the hall to where my mom sat in the living room. Johann gestured with his head. His arms were full, and yelled to my mom, "What's up?" "Hello there," said Mom. In general, we had a great arrangement, my mother and I. She was very supportive of my dream to be a director, very accommodating of my artistic whims. In return, I cooked her meals and cleaned the bathroom and the kitchen and took out the garbage. So when Johann finished his laundry and told us he'd been kicked out of his apartment, I had a short conference with Mom, telling her how important Johann would be to my career, and we made a place for him in our home. "Temporary," said Mom. "Of course," I said. I knew this change would be tough on her. Mom was very serious about her work and about being a mother, and her style was so much different than Johann's. That's how she would have put it, different. Or maybe she'd say it was interesting how he never did the dishes. She was reluctant to admit she was 10 times smarter than he was, and that it bothered her to have such a derelict under the same roof. Johann may not have been smart in the same way Mom was, but he was savvy. He was a go-getter. Also, he could be a real and I figured I, you know, could learn something from him, how to be stubborn and selfish and single-minded and uncompromising. I needed these tools to be an artist. Mom wasn't setting a good example in that department. That fall, Johann showed me an article from the Press Herald about the money people were making far down the coast, a few hours from the Canadian border, scuba diving for sea urchins. I was sweeping trash out from under the seats after the late show. "Ladies love fishermen," he said. "That's right," I said. Hold your thoughts for a minute. I ran out to my car to get the camera. When I returned, he said, "Think about it, how cool that would be, us making money as fishermen." I aimed the camera, framing Johann in close-up. "We're rolling," I said. "We'd wear the orange rain jackets," he said. "Tell me about the article," I said. I panned back and then moved around him in a circle, my most dexterous camera trick. $70 a pound, he said. "They sell the eggs to Japan for $70. You see, the Japs..." "Look at the camera," I said. "They kill for these eggs, and the sea urchins, they're everywhere. They say that the bottom of the ocean down the coast..." "What do they call it?" he said, flipping the page of the paper, scanning the article, wrinkling his brow. "Here, a big green carpet," he said. I hit the autofocus, brought the camera to my hip, and while it continued to roll, I snatched the newspaper from his hand. The prospect of doing something real appealed to me. I knew that it would broaden my range as a filmmaker. I'd lived in Maine all my life and had traveled down the coast only once to drive up Mount Cadillac. Mom resisted the plan. She'd been tolerant of Johann to a point, letting him grow marijuana on the windowsills in the kitchen and ignoring that he brought his girlfriends home late at night. But the idea of scuba diving in the wintertime, fumbling around in boats, jockeying for territory with career fishermen far down the coast, well, Mom didn't like the plan. School had started, so she was back at work, and she was unhappy I hadn't enrolled at the U. We were having breakfast. I'd gotten up at 6 to make her eggs and hash. And she said, "I have to say, Sam, my vote is a strong no." "But you understand, don't you?" I asked. "This is something I have to do for my movies." "Jesus, Sam, how can catching sea urchins help with anything?" she asked. She wore small silver hoop earrings and an orange scarf and was shuffling through papers, not even looking me in the eye. "What about your job at the Twilight?" "I need to do something, Mom," I said. "There's always film school," she said. "I want to be in the trenches," I said. "Well, that's exactly where this kid's going to put you, Sam." Then she whispered, even though Johan was fast asleep, "He's a jackass, you know that, Sam." I was livid. "First of all, he's not a kid," I said. "And second of all, you think Rosenberg would have made Cool Hand Luke if his mom kept him at home, locked up like a prisoner?" "It's not that great of a movie," said Mom. I liked this about her. To her, taste was important. She had a bit of a bohemian streak, so her approach with me had always been hands-off. She would argue with me, but she always allowed me to make my own mistakes if I insisted on making them. "But you get my point?" I said. She was quiet and she shook her head. "No. Although, but yes, I suppose in some ways I do." "I need to meet other people," I said. "If it gets bad, I want you to come back," she said. "Definitely," I said. But I wanted to get a taste of what was out there, so I didn't expect to return for a long while. In the beginning, everything flowed as planned. I put my camera and my box of video cassettes in the car, along with a suitcase filled with memorabilia and warm clothes. We headed to Point Allison, 4 hours from Portland, along the slow coastal route. I was anxious to get it all on tape. Johan drove, and I shot video out the passenger window. The colors of the beach and maple trees looked like fire through my viewfinder. We stopped for hot dogs in Bath, where we sat at a picnic table at the Kennebec River near the ironworks. Thick white clouds covered the sky. Johan said, "My wife was in love with being in love, you know? You gotta watch out for that, Sam." "I've seen it 100 times, I said. The blueberry fields we passed in Ellsworth were a mile wide, sweeping down to the ocean, spotted with white granite boulders. I made sure to say things into the microphone that I might forget later about the footage, about smells, faint sounds that couldn't be detected, or feelings I had. I used the telephone poles flitting by to pace my narration like a metronome. From the car window, Sam smells burning brush. Low tide. Dust. When we came to the end of the peninsula, it began to rain, so I pulled the camera inside and rolled up the window. We stopped at a gas station in the center of town. A young boy wearing a full suit of yellow rain gear pumped our gas. The saltbox houses along the main road were missing clapboards, and their lawns were unmowed. The market across from the gas station had plywood covering its windows. Up the hill, there was an unlit diner without any cars in the lot. At the edge of the harbor, a long row of tarp-covered boats sat in wooden cradles resting for the winter. The boy came to the window. Johan put his hand out to me for money, and I obliged. Then he asked the boy, "Where are all the summer homes?" "Who are you looking for?" asked the boy. "No one," said Johan. "There must be some nice houses out there on the shore. We're just touring." Before answering, the boy squinted at us for a few seconds. "Take Spruce Head Drive up there on the left, if that's what you want." As we pulled away from the gas station, I got a tight shot of Johan. He stared straight ahead while the wiper blades slapped the rain. "Cut the shit," he said. So I put the camera down. We drove to the end of the dirt road, past a long stretch of dense spruce forest, to a 2-story cedar-shingled cottage on the back shore. It sat right on the edge of the rocks, with steel pillars keeping it from tumbling in the ocean. Johan said, "This looks good." "You know these people?" I asked. "This place is shut down for the winter. We can camp here until we find a real place to live," he said. He gave me a boost to the wooden rain gutter. I pulled myself up to the eaves, then scooted my way around the house, careful not to slip on the wet shingles, checking each of the second-story windows. I was soaked and cold. I could hear the low rumble of the surf against the rocks, but the rain against the roof and the gutter was louder. All the windows were locked. I got back to where I climbed up, then looked for Johan to tell him the bad news. He was standing in the driveway holding a large black stone, which he cocked back like a baseball and threw past me. It smashed the last window I'd checked. "There you go," he shouted. It was even colder inside the house and damp, but it was carpeted everywhere, even in the wide stairwells. Downstairs, there was a 12-foot plate glass window looking out at the bay. We moved the couches aside, brought mattresses from the 2 beds upstairs, and set them up by the fireplace. The branches we'd collected from the woods were too damp to start a fire, so we used a coffee table from the living room. Johann stepped on top of it, splitting it in half. He snapped off the legs, placed them gingerly on the crumpled newspaper in the fireplace, and once it was going, we topped the fire with spruce branches, which smoked and burned loudly. I set my clothes out to dry. We didn't turn on any lights in the house, so we went to sleep as soon as it got dark. I was dead tired. My dreams were explosive that night, bright and real. I was walking alone on Forest Avenue in Portland. There wasn't anyone else on the street. Then some kind of beast started chasing me, breathing loudly and snapping its teeth. I woke screaming, and Johann asked, "Jesus, are you on fire?" I turned to the fireplace and saw only faint coals. "You must have been having a bad dream," he said. "Christ, keep it to yourself, will you?" "Okay," I said, happy to be alive. I didn't want to explain that it hadn't been my fault. There'd been something chasing me. The next day, we went to Brothers Seafood of Point Allison, a dank, unlit place with slush ice spilling off conveyor belts and the fertile smell of cleaned fish. The belts were running at a steady clip with nothing on them. In the far corner, a young woman wearing a t-shirt and rain pants was slapping a small squid against the concrete floor. Johann whispered to me, "Look at this one." I switched my camera on, starting with a shot of the wide fish house doors open to the harbor. A front had passed through, so it was clear and windy, making the water light blue with whitecaps. The woman looked up at us as we walked in, holding the squid by the fleshy crests near its eyes. I zoomed in close. Her red hair was cut short like a boy's. I panned down to her arms, which were covered with a reddish-brown film. She walked across the fish house to us with a squid in her hands. She said, "You taking pictures in here?" She had a square masculine chin, but her eyes were softer. Her eyelashes were long, and her eyebrows were delicate, and the smear of squid guts on her cheek didn't make her look dirty. If it had been a birthmark, it wouldn't have disrupted her good looks. When she got close, I saw how strong her arms and shoulders were. She was about my height, perhaps roughly my weight. But if we'd been wrestlers, she could have easily muscled me to the floor of the fish house in no time at all. I felt immediately ashamed by how little physical labor I'd done in my lifetime. "We're looking for a place to sell sea urchins," said Johann, extending his hand to her. The woman kept her hands on the squid. She laughed. "You read the article in the paper," she said. I was shooting close enough that her blue eyes and freckled cheeks filled my viewfinder. "She smells like rotten herring," I whispered to the microphone. "Easy," she said, putting her hand in front of my lens. I stepped back, turning off the camera. "Do you buy 'em?" Johann asked. "We're closed now," she said. "Can you give us some advice?" "You don't know Point Allison too well, do you?" said the woman. She wiped her forehead with her arm, leaving another red smudge. "We just need a place to sell the ones we catch," said Johann. "Let me tell you a secret," she whispered. "They're not tough to catch." Then she heaved the squid toward Johann, shouting, "Boo!" Johann covered his head and leapt back. She laughed. "You ever been on the water? Come on, what are you really here for? What's with the movie camera?" she asked. "We just want to make some money," said Johann. "You know how to dive? Well, that's what Sam's here for." "Sam," she said, looking at me. I looked away. Her eyes were too shrewd. "You know how to dive?" "No," I said. "You have a boat?" she asked. "We're looking for one," said Johann. "Bring your urchins here when you get them. We'll buy. If I'm not here, you sell them to my father," she said. She walked back to the conveyor belt, knelt down, and went back to work on the squid. That afternoon, Johann and I were warming by the fire. He was telling me about a hooker he knew in Lewiston. When we heard a pounding on the door, I crawled across the carpet along the wall and peeked out one of the porch windows. It was the woman from the fish house. I sat there just for a minute looking. When she pounded again, I crawled back to tell Johann. He asked if I was sure it was her. I said yes. We answered the door together. "How did you know we were here?" he asked. Her pickup truck was running. She wore a wool coat and blue jeans and gripped a white plastic grocery bag. "It's the kind of thing that gets found out pretty easily in a town like this," she said. "You think it's okay if we stay here?" I asked. I caught her fish smell again, which made me want to go get my camera. "I haven't told the cops, if that's what you're asking," she says. "No one likes the people who come here in the summer, so you might be okay." "You want to come inside?" asked Johann. "I'm going home. I just wanted to tell you, I'll dive for you if you put up the money. Get me some new gear. We can use my boat." "Bingo," said Johann. "I'll give you 20% tops She handed me the plastic bag. There's some dinner. Hey, beautiful, what's your name? Asked Johan, propping his hands on his hips. Listen, she said, we can be business partners. I need a couple of lifters, that's all, and you need a diver. And then she turned and walked out to her truck. What's your name? Said Johan. Jane, she said. Good night, Jane, said Johan. The bag contained two squid. I brought a shovel full of embers from the fire to the granite boulders just below the high tide mark. I propped a rock under the lens of the camera and filmed as I cut the tentacles into strips and wrapped them around green spruce branches, toasting them over the coals. After we ate, we built the fire up, lay back on the flat rocks, and looked up at the sky, bright with stars. That girl wants to bed me, said Johan. She does? I asked. The idea of it made my stomach tense. It unnerved me that I had been totally unaware of the romance brewing between them. It made me wonder if there was a frequency of sexual tension which I couldn't dial into. It was outside my range. Or maybe Johan was simply overconfident. That unnerved me, too. If I'd never been able to muster such bravado. Of all people, you should recognize the look she was giving me, Sam, he said. Oh, you're right, I said. Maybe I did see a little something. We sold my car to a mechanic at Point Allison Auto for $800, roughly half what I expected, but it was enough to get the gear for Jane. It's not as though I didn't know he was using me to fund our venture. After all, the car that had been mine, which I'd bought with the money I'd earned at the Twilight, was now being driven by a stranger. It's just that I was willing to compromise. We'd come all this way. We had a decent place to sleep. And if I returned home, I would have to eat crow by telling Mom I'd failed. We started urchining right away. The skiff had a 20-horsepower Evinrude on its stern, and as we motored out of the harbor, I got some great footage of Jane with spruce-tufted islands in the background. When I looked out at the open ocean, I couldn't help but be overwhelmed by its seriousness, its incredible depth and expanse. Looking out to where the earth curved was like trying to imagine the rest of your life, all that remains unknown. But for Jane, I'd get her profile in the foreground of my seascape shots. It seemed as though being on the water was like sitting in the living room. She never looked bored, but she was perfectly at ease. When we reached the bigger swells outside the harbor, water sprayed over the gunwale, and I tucked my camera into the lazarette, a compartment near the stern. I helped her squeeze her hands into thick neoprene gloves, two on each hand, so the urchin spines wouldn't get her. She wore knee pads, so she could kneel on the urchins, too. When she slipped the hood over her head and zipped the front of her wetsuit, she looked like a seal. You wear that well, I said. But she just furrowed her brow. We anchored off the north shore of Hay Island. Jane hefted the iron weight belt around her waist and then slung two tanks on her back. She took the end of a long loop of thick nylon line down with her. In the boat, I held the other end. We tied mesh bags to the loop, spacing them 5 feet apart. She tugged on the line when she filled a bag. The water was churned brown from the recent rains. We pulled up a new bag fat with urchins every few minutes. We filled the skiff in 2 hours. Her face was blanched and her lips were purple when she surfaced. Johan and I each grabbed an arm and pulled her into the boat. I gave her my parka, which she put on over her wetsuit, but she couldn't yet talk. She was too cold. We motored our hull, 10 fish tubs brimming with urchins, glossy and moving like wet grass, back to Point Allison, dumping them in a holding pen in the middle of the harbor. Jane said we'd keep them there until the price went up far enough, and then we'd get Brother to fly them to Osaka. We drove with Jane back to her house, the three of us packed in the cab of her truck with the heat at full bore. When we got to her house, a tiny place, one story, just across from the post office, Johan seemed surprised she wasn't driving us home. Oh, well, no problem. We'll walk from here. Yeah, she said. You've got to warm up, said Johan. Yeah, she said. She was still shaking, and I could tell it pained her to seem less tough than usual. I could help warm you up, said Johan. Johan, she said, smiling, my head's frozen, but I still know you're a loser. I mean, I could start a fire for you, he said. He was smiling, too. Eat some soup, I said. I'll manage fine, she said, opening the truck door and stepping out. You live alone? Asked Johan. Me and my guns, she said. She was being playful, but she wasn't wasting much time in getting from the truck to her house. You'll be okay, he asked. You two should just run along, she said, flicking her fingers in the direction of Sprucehead Drive. I just want to make sure you're not sick, he said. You look really cold. Just wait till January, she said, raising her chin to us as she opened the front door of her house. She stepped inside and closed the door without saying goodbye. I asked Johan, Can you translate for me? Are you joking? No, I said. You don't see it? He asked. He was in a good mood. Not totally, I said. It's the dance, bro, he said. God, I love the dance. Even though I'm sure it was better firsthand, I was thrilled to be watching the dance up close. Johan had told me plenty of stories, but now I was getting to see him in action. We'd been working for a few weeks when Jane suggested that only one of us needed to unload the bags of urchins. We'd be better off using two divers. She started to train me. Her old wetsuit fit me perfectly, and she had extra tanks too. We began in the shallows at the far end of the harbor, in the estuary. We clambered down to the water through the weeds in all of our gear. I had trouble breathing at first. As soon as I went under, I hyperventilated. Jane calmed me by resting a hand on my shoulder and explaining that she'd been the same way at first. I didn't believe it, but I appreciated her efforts to make me feel more at ease. The efforts themselves made me calm down. She gave me lessons at dawn so they wouldn't interfere with our urchining. Jane made sure I knew to exhale when I surfaced, and we eased into deeper water, away from the estuary, where the ocean bottom changed from mud to barnacled granite, and I saw hermit crabs and starfish and skate all magnified through my mask. We'd flash hand signals at each other to communicate. Thumbs up meant we'd surface. She'd pat her buoyancy compensator if she thought I needed to inflate mine, but my favorite gesture was thumb and pointer finger making a circle, the other fingers raised, the okay signal, which we flashed each other many times throughout each dive. It was something I needed to do to stay comfortable. I'd flash her an okay and get an okay back from her immediately. She was so straight-faced most of the time, so inscrutable, that these exchanges made me feel like we were really looking out for each other. At night, Jane started visiting the house where Johan and I were staying. At first, just to bring us firewood, which I paid her for. Little by little, though, her visits lengthened. Often she'd stay for dinner, which was usually hot dogs we'd roast over the fire. I watched Johan and Jane closely, wanting to see what she saw in him. I knew she thought he was selfish and lazy and lecherous, but I also came to see that she liked the challenge he presented. He was extremely confident in everything he did and seemingly unwilling to change. Perhaps she wanted to change him. She was tough that way. But it might have just been that she was lonely and that she liked how much attention he gave her. After one of our shorter work days, the swells had been too high for us to work very long. We couldn't keep the boat from slamming against the Hay Island reefs. We all went back to the house for an afternoon snack of baby crabs. This was something Jane had introduced us to. They were easy to find under rocks at low tide. The smaller the crab, the better it tasted. With an oven mitt, I'd hold a frying pan with melted butter over the fire. Then we'd toss them in. The crabs danced in the browning butter before they turned red. Then we'd pop them in our mouths whole, washing the mess down with beer. I'm glad I'm not in their shoes, said Johan, nodding towards the crabs. Don't be a p***, said Jane. They taste good, right? Besides, they're tougher than you think. They don't need shoes. She said this flirtatiously, which made me think she might have been a little drunk. She'd had four beers. Her cheeks were a little brighter than usual. I thought about the two of us underwater. How quiet it was. Imagine what that's like getting cooked alive, said Johan. Jane laughed. Well, I'll be f***. You really care about these little brainless things. What about all the urchins we kill every day? That's different, said Johan, popping a crab in his mouth, crunching it without hesitation. They don't have eyes. He seemed almost sad. My stance is just not to think about it, she said. The crabs, look out for yourself. That's usually pretty easy for him, I said to Jane. Perhaps I was a little drunk, too. Yes, it is, he said, smiling. And I knew I'd been busted. He'd caught me siding with Jane, trying to make him look bad, and he'd probably also seen me staring at her with curious eyes. Jane slept over that night on a third mattress Johan brought down from upstairs. It seemed he wasn't going to rush things. He let her sleep on his mattress by the fire while he slept in the colder part of the room by the windows. It felt like a chess move. She was 2 feet away from me. But Johan had no reason to feel jealous. He just wanted to show me that even though I liked her, I didn't have the balls to make a move. The next day was my first as an urchin diver. The water was much different than it had been during training. Outside the harbor, the currents were stronger. The visibility was muddied by sediment and algae. As Jane and I descended, a school of minnows shifted direction all at once, and the sun reflected off each of their little bodies like a burst of sparks. The ocean floor was just as the newspaper reported, carpeted with urchins. a bed of nails. When Johan tugged on the loop of bags to tell us the boat was full, Jane waved me over to her. I gave her the okay sign and she flashed it back to me. I put my hand on her arm, but it's difficult to express anything when you've got a mask in your face and a regulator in your mouth, so I gave her another okay. She okayed me back, then pointed at one of the rocks we'd picked clean. She reached down and tugged at it, trying to turn it over, so I helped her, and when we flipped it, we exposed two lobsters with their claws flared. She grabbed them by their midsections, one in each hand, and put them in one of the bags on the loop. This was illegal, I knew. But how would anyone find out? I spotted another lobster crawling backwards away from us, and using her technique, took hold of it and put it in the bag with the other two. Then she gave me the thumbs-up sign, and we surfaced. That night we cashed in, towing the holding pen full of urchins to Brothers. Johan and I came away with 900 each. Jane cooked the lobsters for us at her place on the wood stove in the middle of the living room, which generated enough heat to keep us all in t-shirts. It was a welcome change from the house where we'd been camping. When she brought the lobsters to the table, red and steaming on white paper plates, their brown eyes staring up at me triggered the thought. My camera had been in the lazarette for weeks. Johan stepped from the bathroom where he'd taken a shower and was combing his hair. "You okay, Sam?" he asked Johan. "You look like death." "I'm fine," I said, but I wasn't. The last shot I'd taken was of Jane on our first day of urchining. I'd been too busy learning how to dive and watching Johan's seduction to remember what it was I'd set out to do. Johan slept in her bedroom, as I expected, and I slept on the couch. I tried to be as inconspicuous as possible, but the place was too small. They knew I was listening. I crept out of the house before dawn and walked down to the town landing where we kept Jane's boat. I fetched my camera from the lazarette, feeling for it in the dark. When I got back to the main road, I waited on the shoulder with my thumb out for only 15 minutes before a truck, loaded with the urchins we'd hauled, heading southbound, gave me my first ride of the day. I was in Portland by nightfall. When he woke up, seeing me gone, I'm sure Johan thought I'd left so I didn't have to watch them fall in love. Maybe he was partly right. But what he didn't know was that I couldn't be a doer and a watcher. I had to split, that much was clear. Maybe there was still a movie there in all that mess. I had to wait and see.
Thomas Gibson read Lewis Robinson's Seeing the World. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The president of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott, and the artistic director of Symphony Space is Laura Kaminsky. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2010 by Richard Russo. Additional support has been provided by Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is also supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.